Hi, Professor Landau, please.
Yeah, hi, speaking.
Hi, Professor Landau. This is Matt Levin.
Yeah, hi there.
And thanks again for agreeing to talk to me this morning.
Okay.
It's not too early, is it?
No.
Okay. I did review the essay that you wrote in Paul Buell's book, so I hope we won't recover too much ground, but I guess some of those questions are, I might want to elaborate on a little bit. But I guess the first question I had is, you mentioned that you landed in the airport in Madison, but you didn't quite explain how you got to Madison and why you came to the University of Wisconsin from New York.
There?
Yeah.
I seemed about the right distance from home,
okay.
And they had a good football team.
That was it, huh?
Basically, yeah.
Fair enough. So there was, you were looking to get away from New York for family reasons or for political reasons or just because?
No, I had really neither.
Okay.
I just thought it would be sounded like a fun place. I'd never been there.
Fair enough. So did you know anybody at the university when you landed or?
No.
No, just coming kind of fresh, huh?
I met two guys on the plane.
Yeah. That were coming as well as first-year students, as freshmen?
Yeah, uh-huh.
And what was your family background in New York? Was there a politics in your background, or was that something you just kind of found in Madison?
No, my parents were basically New Deal Democrats.
Uh-huh. And so you didn't have a kind of leftist background in New York?
No.
All right.
My uncles and aunts were communists.
Yeah.
But I didn't have much contact with them.
Yeah. And so when you got to Madison, you quickly, or not within a year or so, had joined the kind of unofficial communist youth group on campus.
Well, it was the Joe Must Go Club that got me involved.
Okay. You met some people on campus who were involved in that?
Well, a woman named Cora Rubin recruited me.
She did,
to
okay.
To carry petitions.
Yep.
To recall McCarthy.
Right. And that was your first introduction to this
yeah,
kind of...
Yeah, I think I was also influenced by... Well, you know, I'd grown up with, you know, a New Deal background and belief in freedom and so on, so I was... I think most liberals at that time responded to McCarthyism in the same way, with repulsion.
Right, right. So how did you get from the kind of the anti-McCarthy group, the Joe Must Go movement, into the Labor Youth League?
Well, I found the people in the league who talked to me to be very convincing.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I mean, there was this, you know, mysterious part of it.
Right.
Secret meetings and all that must have been attractive.
Right. Right. You mentioned that in your essay. Kind of this allure of the secret. Henry Wardus.
Yeah.
I spoke to him a few months ago, and he had some interesting things to say. What kind of things did the Labor Youth League do? I mean, you mentioned a little bit, inviting speakers to campus, meetings, reading.
We would
reading.
Leaflet factories.
You would, okay. With issues of the...
We'd hand out the worker.
Yeah.
I forget what else we handed out. I honestly don't remember.
Sure. So you would go to the factories and hand out these leaflets or newspapers?
In the morning, yeah.
What kind of response did you get?
Laughs.
Not much, huh?
Well, most of the workers thought we were kind of funny.
Yeah.
There wasn't much hostility.
Yeah.
We also leafleted the black areas of Madison.
What kind of handing out the same literature?
No, this was race stuff.
Okay. Stuff coming from...
Fairly positive response.
Yeah. You mentioned that you actually met in some of the black neighborhoods of Madison.
Yeah, that's where one of the guys lived.
Oh, okay. And so you met at his house. In
yeah.
that neighborhood.
Yeah.
What kind of things did you...
We would be inconspicuous, see?
Right. Right, a whole bunch of white kids tromping down to this neighborhood, right?
Well, the meetings were very small because one group didn't know another group.
Okay.
So I knew maybe four or five other people, and that's all.
Right. Did that ever change, or was that true for
No, it didn't change.
That was always true.
And wisely so.
Yeah.
In those days, I mean, I don't know if Henry told you, but he couldn't get into medical school.
He told me that he had some problems, yeah.
And it was, you know, strictly related to his political activity.
Yeah, yeah. So that was, so all the way through the group's existence, you only knew, you know, four or five members plus maybe the couple of public members that existed.
Yeah, I mean, I suspected who other people were, but I didn't know.
Right, right. Now, you mentioned in...
There were some people I never knew.
Yeah.
Who I found out years later.
Right, right.
Yeah.
You mentioned in your essay in Paul Buell's book that you weren't necessarily a big supporter of Stalin.
No, I mean, I never could buy the Stalin stuff.
Yeah. How important was that to the League to begin with, to other members and to the group?
Well, to the party, it was crucial.
Right.
That's why, you know, in 1956, so many people got so, you know, unglued when Khrushchev said that the good guy was really the bad guy.
Right.
And all the stuff we said was not true turned out to be true.
Right.
So, you know, it was very destabilizing.
Yeah. Before that, were other members of the League that you knew, were they more committed to kind of supporting Stalin than you were, or was that kind of a general feeling? That
yes, I think the people who came from more communist backgrounds were more, you know... Well, I mean, the party didn't encourage a sense of humor either.
Right. Now, one of the things...
And that always, you know, I was always sort of called down for that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, don't kid around. Don't make fun of this and that. I couldn't help it.
You were for the humor, not for your lack of support for Stalin, but for kind of
right.
The... One of the things that Henry did mention is that you, you know, you and maybe some of the other members that were involved in kind of the later Labor Youth League were had more cultural interests, less interest in kind of the kind of dogmatic aspects of Marxism. And,
yeah, that's true.
And more of this cultural interest. That was true.
Yes.
Yeah. So when the Labor Youth League ends, it ends because of kind of the revelations about Stalin and the, you know, the invasion of Hungary, those kind of, as you mentioned, destabilizing events.
Well, that's why the League ended.
Yeah.
On campus, we've been suspended, though.
For the Pete Seeger concert, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that happened before the end of the League.
It did. Okay.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the
so
time.
So it virtually ended it, you know, for us.
Right. So it seems like there was a pretty quick transition to another group, the Socialist Club.
And much broader.
Right. So the Socialist Club included people from the League, like yourself,
mm-hmm.
and Ron Radosh, and maybe a couple of others. But it also included other people.
Oh, absolutely.
How did that work?
British socialists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Labor Party people.
How did that work? How did all of you come together? Do you remember?
No. I mean, I know we took the initiative.
Right.
And then a lot of other people joined.
Right.
And once they did, of course, they also elected people to the executive committee and so on. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, most of us at that point had really, you know, no inclination to continue following the party line. So... it seemed refreshing and good.
Was that the main difference between the Labor Youth League and the Socialist Club? Was kind of this...
Well, there was no line.
Right.
You know, and the Socialist Club contained people who were anti-Soviet.
Right.
So there was no, you know, there was no party line. Anybody who believed in socialism could become a member.
And what kind of things did you do differently in the socialist club?
You know, we didn't leaflet or anything. It was mainly, you know, camp. It was mainly a campus thing. I think we had some political debates. And,
mm-hmm.
And as I recall, we used to put on the anti-military ball.
Right.
And that, again, you know, it was cultural. It was a lot of fun. We, you know, we'd write musicals and stuff like that.
Right, right.
Marshall Brickman was with us then.
Mm-hmm, right.
He later, you know, wrote Annie Hall with Woody Allen.
Right, right.
He was a talented, both a talented musician and lyrics writer.
Yeah.
So I wrote, you know, that with him on one occasion. We started having a lot more fun.
Yeah. And why more fun? Was it the freedom from kind of the party line?
Well, I mean, labor usually seemed like work.
Yeah.
You know, you were doing, I mean, the whole idea of the Communist Party
mm-hmm.
was that you were playing a role in history and you better, you know, damn well shape up.
Right.
Be disciplined and so on. Didn't leave a lot of room for fun. And once you got off of that kick that you were now a member of this elite body, chosen to be an actor on the stage of modern history, you could then, your brain could operate in a lot broader capacity.
Right. So that was an important distinction.
Yeah.
What was, there's been a lot of discussion about kind of the break at some point around 1960 or the early 60s between the old left and the new left.
Yeah.
And it sounds like what you're kind of describing in terms of the Socialist Club is kind of that break in some ways.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think most of the people who were in the LYL were, you know, not very dogmatic people or, I mean, after all, we were kids anyway.
Right.
So, we didn't take it all that hard. The adults seemed to take it a lot harder. People, you know, some of the older brothers of the people or, you know, parents.
Yeah.
Took the revelations of the 20th Party Congress, the invasion of Hungary. I mean, they took this very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
We took it seriously, but, you know, we didn't have that history. We didn't have that length of commitment.
Right, right.
And then the Cuban Revolution also was an important feature. And anyway, I mean, it all led us into studies on the left.
Right. How did studies on the left actually kind of, how did it emerge? I mean, was it just the result of some informal discussions?
It was people who were in the LYL,
mm-hmm.
along with people who had just come to Madison to study with Professor Williams.
Mm-hmm. Now, you weren't one of Professor Williams' students?
Not formally, no.
Okay.
Although I took classes with him, and later we became really good friends
mm-hmm.
After he left Madison.
Right.
But when I did come back after my second trip to Cuba, he took the initiative and introduced me to a big, you know, public gathering, which I thought was very nice of him.
Right.
I was very proud because when I was his student, he treated me like shit.
That was kind of sometimes the way things were done then, huh?
Well, I mean, I think, yeah. I mean, later on, as he said, he began to, he told me that he didn't really appreciate me until I'd left college. And,
So, what, now, the studies on the...
You weren't one of those who toadied to me. I said, well, I was trying.
You just weren't good enough at it, huh?
I didn't do it well.
What did, so a lot of the students, a lot of the people, or at least some of the people associated with studies on the left were Williams students.
Yes.
or knew him very well.
Yeah, so I forget, David Akins
mm-hmm.
Was one. I don't remember who else was on the board now, the early board. I think Bill Ruff was one of his students.
I think the early board
Nancy
was...
O'Connor.
The first board was, well, there was you and Marty Sklar and Carl Weiner.
Oh, well, yeah, Carl Weiner.
Wiener and Dean Sandberg.
Dina, yeah, these were students. These were not part of the old LYL.
They weren't.
No,
they came a little later.
Yeah.
And Steve Sheinberg.
Also not.
Right. So what did? How much of Williams was, you know, in his scholarship and his, you know, ideology? How much of that was a part of studies, and how much of, you know, the influences that you were drawing from came from other sources?
I think Williams was a driving force in the sense that it was historically oriented, and revisionist in the sense that, you know, Williams was a historical revisionist.
Right.
So it was attacking Cold War history and ideology. But I think it was also an influence from C. Wright Mills. And there was a literary influence. I mean, Eleanor Hakem and Dina Stanberg were both English majors.
Oh, okay. Well, I knew Eleanor was. I didn't know that about Dina.
Yeah, and Arthur Hack, I think, was also on there. He was also an English major.
Okay. So there was kind of that literary cultural influence.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which was good, I thought.
Yeah. Now you mentioned in your essay that you met C. Wright Mills at some point and you worked with him a little bit before he died.
Yeah.
Were you already familiar with him in the mid-50s from some of his earlier
books?
Well,
we read his books.
Right.
We read all of his books.
The Power Elite.
The Power Elite, the White Collar. The one on labor, I don't remember the title.
Yeah. How did those books play in into studies on the left? You know, how did
well, there were always debates as to, you know, because Mills was not a Marxist.
Right.
And the Marxists had a hard time with him distinguishing ruling class from power elite. But I remember Paul Sweezy wrote an essay on it, but not a very convincing one. And Mills opened up, you know, broader vistas. And there was another influence in Madison, who was Hans Gerth, who was often Mills's partner, and especially in the translations of Max Weber. But they also wrote a textbook together on social psychology.
Was Gerth originally Mills's graduate advisor?
No, I don't think so.
No,
I think they just came together.
Okay.
I don't think they had ever had that relationship.
Okay.
Gerth couldn't write very well in English, and that was one of the problems.
Right.
And Mills, I mean, Gerth always complained that Mills took his ideas and so on. I think that was bullshit, though.
Yeah.
I mean, Mills didn't need anybody to, he was a very smart fellow.
Right, right. So you were all familiar with Hans Gerth as well?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Now, who was actually, one of the questions I had, and you actually, I came across a letter written by you, I think to Eleanor Hakem in 1960 or so, talking about who was reading Studies on the Left and saying that not too many people were, that it was kind of maybe a little too highbrow or something along those lines.
Both of them enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Both readers.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know.
All two of them. So that was a concern. Were folks interested in a wider readership, or, you know, how?
I have to tell you, I don't really remember.
Yeah.
I mean, I do recall that it was hard to read. It was hard for me to read.
Yeah.
And I didn't like those kind of, you know, I still don't like them.
Yeah.
When I have to go through language that isn't clear to me, I just feel funny, you know, I don't like them.
Right, right. So how did Studies get to the point? There was this, I don't know if you remember, but there was this editorial, and I think it was in 1961, that was very critical of liberals. And, you know, as being the driving force rather than the right, but the liberals being the driving force between in the Cold War, both kind of abroad and at home. That becomes kind of a major theme in the New Left in the later 60s, this criticism of liberals. But Studies was already articulating this in, you know, 1961 or something like that.
Well, that was the Williams line.
It was.
Yeah.
So that largely came from him.
Yeah, and then Jimmy Weinstein wrote a book essentially about corporate liberalism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Jimmy became the driving force by, I guess, 1961.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I left Madison. I left Madison in, really, in the
late spring of 1960. And that was really the end of my active participation in study.
How did it change after that point? I assume you kind of kept up with it. And...
Well, I mean, it just, you know, how did it change? Well, I moved to New York later. And
right.
Tom Hayden and other people got involved in it. And it just became a little bit more movement-oriented, but it never got rid of that, you know, sort of pedantic, how should I say it, graduate school quality.
Gotcha. Okay.
Part of that stuck with it, but it did become a little bit more readable.
Okay. So some of the changes were positive.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did your own politics, maybe I guess we're backstepping a little bit, but, you know, so you came to Madison, your parents were maybe New Deal liberals or New Deal Democrats. You get involved in the Labor Youth League and then these other things. How do you chart your own kind of political evolution or political change over some of those years?
Well, I think Cuba had really, you know, my trip to Cuba made a big difference because I saw people my age running ministries and taking huge responsibility,
mm-hmm.
and I saw that you could actually accomplish something if you worked together.
Mm-hmm.
And that, that I think, had a big effect on me. And then I moved to San Francisco, where, you know, I got involved in a lot of the cultural stuff as well.
Right.
With the mime troupe.
Oh, really? Okay.
I was the playwright for the mime troupe for a while.
Oh, I didn't know that. In the San Francisco mime troupe?
Yeah.
Hmm. You know, they came, you've probably heard the story, them coming back in 1967 and being a part of, you know, the big demonstration on campus that year.
Yeah.
So what else was it about Cuba? I know that you were very interested in it then and you continue to be interested in it now. What was it about the Cuban Revolution that was so interesting for you and for a lot of others too?
Well, I said, first, I mean, it seemed to be refreshingly new.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, it was made by very young people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think Castro was 29, was
mm-hmm.
it? He was born in 26, so 59, he was 30, what?
33?
Yeah, 33.
Mm-hmm.
He was the old guy.
Right.
And it was open, and it was fun-loving, and it was, you know, bold, and, you know, daring to stick its finger straight in Uncle Sam's eye.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, it got a lot of people involved. I mean, a lot of them got uninvolved as soon as they allied with the Soviets.
Right. But you didn't. You continued.
No, I didn't because I didn't. I thought that there was... The alliance was a necessary one in the sense that who else would have insured this revolution? You know, there was no other insurance company in the world that would have written a policy on them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so if they didn't go with them, they would have died.
Right.
And, you know, history proved that they outlasted them.
Right, that's true.
It continues to be its own place. I mean, I'm not an uncritical supporter as...
Right.
I don't know if you saw the article I wrote, I don't know, some years ago, 15 years ago now, in Mother Jones.
No, I didn't see it.
Anyway, it was called Time to Go, and I said, you know, Castro should have stepped down.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I continue to support the Cuban Revolution. I mean, in the sense that it's a success.
Mm-hmm.
In its own terms.
Mm-hmm.
It took a informal colony of the United States
mm-hmm.
and made it an independent player on the world stage.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to, you look around the world, what other small third world country has played such a role in world history?
Right, especially one that's so close to the United States.
Yes, and continues to do so.
Right, right.
So, you know, it's a fascinating place.
Mm-hmm. Were others that you knew at the time, though, they kind of lost their involvement because of the alliance with the Soviets?
Well, some did, some didn't. I mean, it certainly cut the broad appeal
yeah.
of the Cuban Revolution, that's for sure.
Yeah. What about women involved in the Labor Youth League and the Socialist Club? Were there a lot of women, or were they predominantly men? I mean, I know you didn't know everyone in the Labor Youth League, but...
Well, there were quite a few women.
There were?
Yeah.
And they held their own? Was it...
Yes, I mean, in those days, the party had equal rights, right? And there was no question about that. Women and men were supposed to have equal rights. We were supposed to share child care, and we were supposed to share housework.
Supposed to, yeah.
Yeah, and I think, albeit, no question that there was sexism, but
sure.
By and large, the women in that group were much freer and much more confident in terms of their own rights than most other women were.
Yeah. Now, was the, talking about, like, this free atmosphere, was there a world outside of politics? I mean, you mentioned a little bit about the anti-military ball and kind of the fun stuff that comes later. Was there kind of a music scene in the mid-50s? Was there, drugs or kind of any hint of a sexual rebellion to come? Or was that kind of bohemian lifestyle not quite apparent yet?
Well, there was a bohemian lifestyle, but it was more sort of anarchist beatnik than it was anything else.
Yeah.
Remember, this was the era of the Beats. And,
right.
I remember one woman who was in the LYL. I was shocked because I was a freshman, and she was all dressed in black and told me that she was an anarchist and described her sex act last night, the night before. And I was, totally shocked and thrilled, of course, at the same time.
Right.
But I don't think this had to do with politics so much.
Yeah.
And it wasn't prevalent.
It was a small group.
It was not prevalent in the LYL. In other words, it was not, there was not a lot of prudery in that sense, but there was certainly not promiscuity.
Right.
At least not that I knew of.
Right.
But there was a music scene. I mean, everybody was very much into, folk music, and Pete Seeger was a great hero.
Mm-hmm. Was jazz music also important?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I mean, well, it depends on who it was. Some people liked, some people
sure,
didn't.
Sure, sure.
But I love both folk and jazz and pop. I mean, I liked all music, and I still do.
Right. What, one of the things that I'm writing about is McCarthyism and kind of the context of the university and how the university dealt with kind of this period. What kind of influence did you, or what role did McCarthyism seem to play in campus politics as far as, you were concerned or you could tell?
Well, I think the university both responded to McCarthyism in the sense of making rules and regulations that made it difficult, but it didn't outlaw. I think the LYL in Wisconsin probably was the only one that was active.
Mm-hmm.
Because, well, first of all, Madison, was a very liberal city.
Mm-hmm.
And Wisconsin had McCarthy on the one hand and a socialist mayor in Milwaukee.
Right.
And it had both things going on at the same time. And the editorials in the Madison Capital Times were, viciously anti-McCarthy.
Mm-hmm.
And the Joe Must Go movement was centered in Madison, So the university had some liberal pressures on it as well. So it sort of made a compromise in that it would let the LYL function, but put restrictions on it. And of course, the LYL only allowed two members to surface.
Right. Because it had to, right? It had to register those
but,
with the university.
Then there were the returning Korean War veterans who were extremely angry and bitter.
Mm-hmm.
And had no interest in fact, were downright hostile to any, pro-commie stuff after they, got shot at and seen their buddies die and so on.
Right. So was there active kind of harassment or intimidation of...
No, it wasn't organized. It was just, some guys would see us and when we demonstrated something and, they'd want to beat us up and stuff.
Right.
Understandably.
Right.
Because the GI Bill was operating then.
Right. So what do you make of kind of the universities, it still holds up this principle of civil liberties and free speech, you know, this commitment to the Wisconsin idea, sifting and winnowing, as
yeah,
you know, this
well,
phrase
the truth, is. Can the truth be found, right?
Right.
Listen, if each university would stick to that one, we'd be all right. I mean, the problem now is that universities are becoming more and more openly adjunct of the corporate world, and
mm-hmm.
you know, intent mainly on supplying entry-level personnel,
mm-hmm.
which was not the case when I was in school. I mean, there was the ag school and the pharmacy school, but the business school was not prominent.
Mm-hmm.
As business schools are now prominent.
Right. So it seems like that shift, that change had not taken place yet when you were when
no,
you were at Madison.
We were, the universities were still had the job of educating citizens and not training corporate entry personnel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which is what they seem to be now, certainly the one I teach at.
Mm-hmm. So the idea of the university at that time kind of upholding these ideals seems to be genuine.
Yeah, I think so, and I think but at the same time there was a huge intimidation factor, and that anybody who didn't see it was blind.
Mm-hmm.
People were very careful.
Right.
The advisor to the Labor Youth League was Karl Paul Link.
Right.
The only untouchable professor at the university.
Absolutely. He was very valuable.
Yeah, he brought in tens of millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't going to touch him. He had no interest in the Labor Youth League, by the way.
He didn't?
None. He never showed up, never talked to us, never advised us. He would simply sign the necessary form.
Right.
As a free speech gesture.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody else stepped forward, you know, in his place.
Now, was that true as well of the Socialist Club?
No,
or?
The Socialist Club was, we're in a different time, and it's a different organization.
Mm-hmm. So there wasn't the same kind of pressure?
No,
do you think it was a combination of those two things? Was it a change of time? Was it just the 5 years difference or the 3 years difference? Or was
well, by 1957, 58, you have the thaw.
Right.
And McCarthy goes down in 54.
Right.
And so, you know, that's a relief in that period.
Yeah, yeah.
What
do you think about the, you know, a lot of the writing on the 1950s talks about students, and, you know, this is actually even true as I read through the Daily Cardinal and such, you know, there's a lot of discussion of apathy on campus and, you know, the silent generation.
Yeah.
What did you think of, and what did you and your colleagues think of the rest of campus, you know, the engineering campus, the ag campus?
We had no contact with them.
None at all?
None.
Yeah.
I don't think I knew, you know, or had in my friendship circle any engineer or ag students.
Right.
I mean, I knew some guys who came from farms, but they weren't studying agriculture. They were studying English.
Right. So all the members in groups like, you know, involved in studies or, you know, the Labor Youth League were history majors, English majors, sociology majors.
Some were in sciences, too.
Oh, they were?
Sure.
Like the natural sciences?
Yeah, like Henry.
Right, right.
Arnie, I don't remember what Arnie Lieber was majored in, but...
Henry was a physics? Was he a physics major?
I don't remember.
I can't remember.
I think biology, maybe. I don't remember.
You're right. It was the sciences, though.
Yeah.
So what do you think of this label of the silent generation?
There were other scientists as well.
Yeah.
There was a woman who was a physicist, and... But they were all in the arts, letters, sciences, or social sciences,
mm-hmm.
humanities.
Not the more applied fields.
No.
Right. What do you think about this label of the silent generation? So does that make some sense since you were such a minority?
The man in the gray flannel suit,
mm-hmm.
The face in the crowd, and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That was all true. I mean, this was a generation that was scared.
Right.
And that was... economically, you know, the economy wasn't exactly booming then. People didn't have any security.
Mm-hmm.
And the Depression memories hung on many people. And, you know, there's an awful lot of older students, returning veterans.
That's true.
And they were very serious people. I mean, they, you know,
they were back to school in order to better themselves
mm-hmm.
in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, bettering yourself meant, you know, becoming a school teacher.
Mm-hmm. So what is the reason for the jump from the 1950s, you know, the silent generation where folks like yourself are in the vast minority, to the 1960s where things change so much? Is it?
Well, first, I mean, there's two things. One is, I mean, the election of Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
a good-looking, funny guy
mm-hmm.
Who was bristling with enthusiasm and energy.
Mm-hmm.
The real, you know, opening in the Cold War, Khrushchev now, you know, becomes a character on the world stage, the Cuban Revolution brewing in all over the world,
mm-hmm.
The Sino-Soviet split, which, again, throws all of the Cold War ideology into the wastebasket,
mm-hmm.
you know, this indissoluble marriage all of a sudden came apart.
Right.
And, you know, the new left appearing both in the United States and in England
mm-hmm.
by the early 60s. You know, SDS, I think, had its first meeting in 62.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were cultural stuff happening. The birth control pill.
Uh-huh.
You can't, you know, say too much about that.
Right.
In terms of opening up women's sexual mobility.
Right. Right.
And, you know, then the phenomenon of rock and roll
mm-hmm.
and drugs. All of this came, you know, sort of all together
mm-hmm.
and produced what became known as the culture of the 60s. By this time, of course, I was living in San Francisco, which was the heart of it.
Right. And were you there for most of the 60s?
All of the 60s, from 61 on.
Yeah. And what did you think about, you know, kind of the way that cultural scene developed and also the politics of the later 60s?
Well, I wasn't doing much thinking.
You know, there's been a lot of regret, criticism of the later 60s for kind of losing the vision of the new left and, you know.
Well, the new left vision wasn't anything that could have been sustained. I mean, there was no... It was just a vision. It was vague, and it was not
mm-hmm.
anything concrete.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when people started acting out theater in the streets, got everybody in trouble. I'm talking about the Weathermen and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never approved of that stuff.
Yeah,
I thought that was silly. I guess it's my old. The old commie discipline or something. I just thought that was idiotic.
Yeah, yeah.
From the get-go. You don't use violence against people who have so much more violence at their behest.
Right. What about the role of the civil rights movement? I don't know that...
I was active in that, too.
On campus?
On campus, sure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, part of the LYL's mandate was to make sure that these organizations were properly directed. So I was in the NAACP.
You were? Okay.
I was a delegate to the convention in 56.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the Peace Committee and, you know, God knows what else.
So the LYL was interested in civil rights as part of kind of the mandate from the party.
Oh, sure.
And the
party took leadership in it.
Yeah. And that continued to be an interest in the Socialist Club, too, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Do you remember the you know, 1960 sit-ins, and whether those in particular, I know that it was soon after those that, you know, that was in February of 1960, that there was some picketing of some of the downtown stores in
Absolutely.
Madison.
Absolutely. Yeah, I participated in it.
Mm-hmm.
I had gone to the South with two other guys, and we visited... We tried to make links between Madison and Montgomery, Alabama. We went to Reverend Abernathy's church.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I went with Ernie Isaacs and, who was the other guy? I can't remember who else I went with.
When was this? When, you know, was this...
It was in... I can't remember. Sometime in 1960, but I don't remember.
Oh, really? Okay, so kind of on the back end of your time in Madison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we drove down there and, you know... Do solidarity, and exited Reverend Shuttlesworth's church, we were met by an Alabama state trooper who escorted us to the state line in Mississippi. Where we were met by a Mississippi state trooper who escorted us to the state line in Tennessee.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, and then when we went to Tennessee, we went to Nashville and Fisk University, and we met Marion Barry.
Huh?
Who at that time was the head of the Black Student League, or Negro Student League, I forget.
What they called themselves, yeah?
Yeah.
Hmm. So you were very interested in the civil rights movement.
Oh, sure.
Enough to take an extended road trip, huh?
Yeah.
Was that kind of the beginning for kind of this more active politics, the picketing and the marches and the demonstrations?
Oh, sure.
We
did that in the 50s, too. I remember marching against ROTC in my uniform.
Really? Was that...
We had compulsory ROTC.
Right. So there were some demonstrations against ROTC.
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay.
And in those days, a demonstration really counted because there were so few of them.
Right. It was a big deal.
Yeah.
It was kind of commonplace 10 years later.
Mm-hmm.
They were, every weekend affairs.
Yeah. So the people who stayed in Madison beyond that period, right, into the 60s,
mm-hmm.
I think almost all of them stayed really involved. At least I left Madison in June of 60.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, doing several civil rights things during that time.
Mm-hmm. What about, you mentioned Kennedy's election and that he was kind of this attractive, youthful
mm-hmm.
person. So he was someone that people were excited about.
I voted for him.
Uh-huh.
Of course, after listening to his inaugural address, I had second thoughts.
Because of the Cold War emphasis?
Well, we will go anywhere, pay any price, bear mm-hmm. any burden in the defense of liberty.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus.
Right, a cold warrior. Yeah.
Yeah. It turned out he was a wuss.
But he was. But
really?
Yeah. But it was exciting at first.
Yeah, and people that I knew were involved. I remember Mark Raskin
mm-hmm.
came up with his liberal project, and we were involved in the Kefauver versus Stevenson, and then in the 1960s. I mean, we were involved always in the Democratic Party stuff, too,
mm-hmm.
trying to get the most liberal candidate.
Right, right. Didn't always work out.
No, never worked out. I mean, it never worked out in the sense that we never had any real influence, but...
Right. Right. So, you wrote this essay for Paul Buell's book. Was that... You must have written it in the late 1980s, right?
I really don't remember when I wrote it.
The book was published in 1990, so...
I guess it must have been.
Yeah. Any thoughts on some of the things you've written... You wrote anything changed?
I don't remember it.
You don't remember it? It's been a while, huh?
Yeah, I remember reading going through the book and deciding that Nina's essay was absolutely the best in the book.
It was very good. Hers was very thoughtful.
I mean, she took time, and I didn't.
Now, where has she gone since Madison?
She lives here in Oakland.
She does.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other thoughts as we've been? I've kind of run through. The questions.
Well, the university is now archiving my films.
It is?
Yeah, it's the State Historical Society.
Oh, very interesting.
And they threw a big festival of my films in February.
Right. I think I first tried to contact you before then, but I didn't quite catch up because I knew you were coming to town. Was that in April that you were in town, or was it in
February?
Was it in February?
Yeah.
I was hoping to talk to you in person, but...
They're threatening to do another one, but we'll see if it actually happens.
Well, maybe next time I'll be able to meet up with you. I'm still here as well, so one of these days I suppose I'll leave.
Well, who is your professor?
I have two advisors that I'm working with. One is a guy named Tony Michaels, who is an American Jewish historian, and the other is Jeremy Suri, who is the kind of diplomatic historian in the department.
I don't know them. I don't actually know any. I know Andy Stern. I met him.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom McCormick isn't really, he's emeritus.
Right, right. Yeah, the one of the guys I'm working with kind of took over Tom McCormick's position. And
Tom is a good guy.
Oh yeah, I talked to him. He took me to an Irish pub in town, and we talked about Madison over a few beers. So it was a lot of fun. I took a seminar from him before the semester before he retired. I'm not sure if you ever read the paper, the seminar paper that I wrote or not, but he gave me a good grade, so I don't know.
Well, he must have been good.
I guess so. I don't know. He was kind of half, I think 1 foot was already out the door, so I don't know if he was paying all that much attention or not.
I like him very much.
Yeah, me too. Me too. He mentioned that there was kind of a couple different groups, you know, in the early, in the history department. One was kind of the Labor Youth League folks, and then there were him and Lloyd Gardner and maybe a couple other people. And Walter Lefebvre, yeah. And that there was, you know, that there was interaction between these groups. But
it was very good interaction, too, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was good cross-fertilization. I learned a lot from them, certainly.
Yeah.
And, you know, we remained friends.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we have all a mutual admiration society. It's very nice.
It's good to have those friends, huh?
Yeah, I mean, the only one who bolted was Radosh.
Right.
That's because we didn't pay enough attention to him.
Is that why that is?
I don't know.
He's someone I've contacted as well. I haven't quite met up with him yet, but...
Well, he was always a whiner.
Was he?
Yeah, from the day I met him. I don't think that's changed. Anyway, what else to tell you? I think that's, you know, basically it, that this was an extraordinary group of young people
mm-hmm.
who were attracted by an extraordinary group of scholars
mm-hmm.
who were conservative historian, but, you know, whose civil liberty stance made him, you know, also an attractive person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Bill Heseltine was, you know, such an irascible and but at the same time, really disciplined historian, and Merrill Jensen.
Now, as long as we're on the subject, when you come to Madison, how are you influenced by, you know, what's this process by which you kind of become influenced by the ideas or the attitudes of these professors? You know, I'm trying to get a sense of that, how that process plays out.
Well, I think it's word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
A student a friend tells you to take this course, and this guy is really terrific, and you
mm-hmm.
take it, and then you tell others.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's mainly how it works.
And so even just in the coursework itself, there was a lot of education going on,
Well, I think I had the best education from my fellow students.
Mm-hmm.
We would sit in the State Historical Society and discuss all the books we'd read, and we'd have fierce arguments and debates.
Mm-hmm.
over interpretations of history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there must have been 2 dozen people involved in this, and you never knew who you'd meet there, and then you'd go to the Rathskeller and continue it.
Yeah.
And it was constant. This was the most ideal intellectual community I could have imagined.
Mm-hmm.
It was constant struggle with ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And so the professors, I think, were equally stimulated.
Did they ever come to meet you in the Historical Society? Or was that just students?
No, we didn't want them.
Yeah.
No, it was... that would have sort of broken the whole process.
Right, right.
Well, but, you know, we'd have dinners and we'd have parties and...
Mm-hmm.
But nobody ever lost an opportunity to have a discussion.
Right.
And that was really nice.
So it was a very kind of stimulating environment.
Yeah. And each professor, you know, I think was in turn stimulated.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Russian professor, even though he was very much a Cold Warrior,
mm-hmm.
he was an exciting lecturer, and he made Russian history exciting, Mike Petrovich.
Right. So
and
there was
a guy who taught Chinese history, who was also... You know, what was his name? Boardman.
Mm-hmm. Eugene Boardman.
Yeah.
Now, who was your advisor?
Beal.
Were you? But you ended up working closely with Williams as well.
Well, I did. I mean, Beale gave me my jobs in the sense that I started out as his research assistant after I graduated,
mm-hmm.
and then I was his TA. But I was a TA for several professors. I don't remember. There was another guy named Robert Lively who was a visiting professor or an assistant professor, and he was also very good.
Okay. That's a name I wasn't familiar with.
And Leon Litwack came there as a visiting professor, and he was exciting.
For a year, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the point is that these people came in part because of the reputation that Madison had gained.
Right. Right. Sounds like an exciting time.
It was. It was. I mean, when I look back, I can't think of how I could have gotten a better education.
Well, great. Well, thank you very much for talking to me this morning.
I hope you finish up fast.
I'm working on it. Trust me.
Right.
I'm working on it. Like I mentioned before, I'm gonna try and transcribe our conversation. Are you interested in me sending you a copy of it just for whatever purposes? Or nah.
Sure, why not?
I'll send it to you. If you never look at it, that's fine, too.
Thank you.
And I will... I'm also, in the next year or so, I'm going to try and get together all these tapes that I've done.
Did you talk to Marty Sklar?
I haven't talked to him.
Have you tried?
No, I haven't tried.
Okay.
I should try, correct?
Sure. Absolutely. I haven't talked to him for a long time. And Carl Perini.
I haven't talked to Carl Perini either.
I didn't mention his name. Hold on a second.
Sure.
Bye. Sorry.
That's all right. And how about Nina? I guess I should contact her,
Nina.
Too. Some of these, some folks I have a hard time getting a hold of because I'm...
She's Nina Serrano at yahoo.com.
Oh, that's pretty simple, huh? And she's in Oakland, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm kind of in this process. I've talked to a bunch of people, but, you know, not everyone I've talked to is part of the kind of left. Like, I talked to a few editors of the Daily Cardinal from the 50s, and this guy, Dave Trubeck, and his wife, now Louise Trubeck, then Louise Grossman. And they were kind of on the liberal end of things rather than the left.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, trying to get this whole thing, trying to get different perspectives. But yeah. That's great. Very helpful. Lots of good information about the Labor Youth League and studies on the left and Professor Williams, which are all kind of central subjects that I'm writing about. So, yeah, thank you.
Okay, good luck to you.
Thanks a lot. I hope I run into you again sometime.
All right, well, look for the posters if they do invite me back.
All right, I'm sure they will at some point.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye.